Our final case of the day is United States against Jones.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Bruce. My name is Carol Dyson, and I represent the party bringing this criminal appeal. The facts of this case embodied the age-old adage of rush to judgment. In March of 2002, Kiefer Jones was arrested on a criminal complaint.
Ms. Jones, you know you can lower the podium if you want. No, not the microphone. Oh. Please don't touch the microphone. The whole podium. There's a switch on your right-hand side.
I'm fine, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you. As I stated earlier, in March of 2002, Kiefer Jones was arrested on a criminal complaint. An affidavit that was attached in support of the criminal complaint indicated that Mr. Jones was alleged to have possessed, with the intent to distribute, a large quantity of crack cocaine. The affidavit further alleged that the crack cocaine was seized from a residence purported to be inhabited by Mr. Jones. Additionally, the affidavit alleged that Mr. Jones had provided the government with a written statement and that he had signed the statement. Mr. Jones was indicted on April 5th, 2002, and the matter was set for trial on June 10th, 2002. Incidentally, at the initial appearance, Mr. Jones and his attorney was provided with a copy of the criminal complaint and the affidavit as well. The government then provided Mr. Jones with a copy of the discovery on May 28, 2002, and this included a copy of the actual written statement referred to in the law enforcement official's affidavit. On May 30, 2002, Mr. Jones filed a motion to continue. His attorney indicated that he would need additional time to prepare for trial, and that motion was granted by the district court. The matter was reset for trial on July 15, 2002, with a final pretrial on June 28, 2002. At the final pretrial, Jones's attorney learned that the government's position with respect to the written statement was that Jones had not only signed the written statement, he had authored the written statement. This was in direct contrast to Jones's trial attorney's incorrect assumption that the government was taking the position that Jones had only signed the statement. After conferring with his client, who then denied writing and signing the statement, Jones's attorney, less than a week later, filed a motion to continue. There was a hearing held on the motion, and the motion was denied. Now, in determining whether or not to grant a motion to continue in any case, the district court must take into account several factors. Perhaps in this case, the most important factor is the amount of time available for preparation. The district court, as well as the government, take the position that Jones's trial counsel was aware of the existence of this purported confession in March of 2002 when he was provided a copy of the criminal complaint and affidavit. But this argument in conclusion is somewhat misleading, Your Honors. Jones's attorney was not taking the position that he was unaware of the existence of this written statement. His position was that he misunderstood the government's position with respect to who had actually written the statement. And, you know, after all, he had not been provided with a copy of that statement until 2 weeks prior to the new trial date. And because he had not been provided with a copy of that statement, he was unable to confer with his client and show his client this statement. I submit that this assumption was not unreasonable. Very often in criminal investigations, law enforcement officials will, in fact, write out a statement and have a suspect sign that statement. There are a variety of reasons for this. The most common would be a lack of education on the part of the defendant. So I do not believe that it was unreasonable for Mr. Jones's attorney to assume that the statement had in fact been written by law enforcement officials and only signed by Jones. I might also point out that This statement purported to have been made by Jones was a Rule 16 discovery. It was not a 3500 material, and it could have been, you know, disclosed much earlier to the defendant. In this case, Your Honors, we're talking about less than a week's time from learning the government's position to filing the motion to continue asking for a handwriting expert. The district court should also consider the availability of discovery from the prosecution. Again, this statement clearly fell under Rule 16 and was not 3500 material and could have been provided to Jones earlier. The court also considers the defendant's role in shortening the effective preparation time. Again, Jones's attorney's assumption was reasonable, and Jones himself was not aware of the government's position until he was informed of such by his attorney. The likelihood of prejudice from the denial and the likelihood that a continuance would satisfy the movement's needs. The government, again, as well as the district court, took the position that the testimony from a handwriting expert as to who actually authored the document would be of no use to the jury. Quite frankly, I'm at a loss at this conclusion. The government cites other evidence included in the case and the overwhelming nature of that evidence. One, that an indicia of identification was found next to or near a quantity of crack cocaine. However, what the government failed to point out is that a quantity of crack cocaine was found in another room with no indicia of identification next to that. And during the pre-raid surveillance, law enforcement officials observed a total of three people going in and out of that house. The drugs could have easily belonged to one of the other individuals, certainly the drugs in another room. The government also argues, as well as the district court, that the officer who took the confession would testify to that fact and that other officers would testify that Mr. Jones made oral statements. I admit that evidence of this nature is very compelling to a jury, but it cannot be said that if a handwriting expert had testified that Jones had not, in fact, authored that document, that the jury would not have regarded the testimony of the law enforcement officials with some suspicion. And lastly, I want to wrap up and note that the court also considers inconvenience to the trial court. There's no indication in the trial record that the trial court would have been inconvenienced in continuing this matter, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Dyson. Mr. Bruce.
May it please the court, Colin Bruce, on behalf of the United States. I was the trial attorney in this case. We'd ask that you affirm the judgment and conviction in this matter. I'd like to start off by clarifying one point Ms. Dyson raised regarding the timeline. By May 30th of 2002, all the discovery, including a copy of the statement, had already been provided. The trial was reset to July 15th, so perhaps she misspoke when she said less than a week before the trial. The defendant actually had an original copy or a copy of the actual statement a month and a half before the trial was set. It wasn't until literally on the eve of trial, some 12 days before, that suddenly there was some realization that the statement is not only written by, not only signed by Jones, but also written by Jones. Frankly, I'm still at a loss to understand the difference between signing a statement and writing and signing a statement, especially one of this brevity. In essence, that regardless of how you want to calculate or how Ms. Dyson calculates the analysis on the various factors for the motion to continue, number one, there's no indication in the record whatsoever that Judge McCuskey's decision to deny the continuance was arbitrary. He considered the factors. He discussed the amount of time the defendant was aware of the statement, even before he was indicted, the actual language in the statement, the fact that discovery had been provided more than a month and a half before the trial. He concluded that properly, that the defendant did not adequately use his time or properly use his time to prepare. He also pointed out that all the evidence was outlined in the complaint 4 months before the trial. All the discovery had been provided, as I said before, more than a month and a half before trial. So the defendant clearly had adequate time to prepare for the July 15th trial date. And finally, this wasn't a complex case. We're talking about a single search warrant of an apartment resulting in seizure of distribution amounts of crack. And two confessions separated by a period of 3 days. There's no indication that there was any arbitrariness on behalf of Judge McCuskin denying the continuance. Likewise, there's no indication of actual prejudice. As I said, I'm at a loss to understand the difference between a defendant signing a statement or a defendant writing and signing the same statement. There's no indication there was inadequate time to prepare. Detective Ramey was thoroughly cross-examined about the statement. And finally, the general claim that, we suffered prejudice, the standard isn't could more time have helped, it's what was the prejudice, and there wasn't any. Unless the court has any questions, I'll return the balance of my time.
Yes, I'm worried about this prior drug conviction. What was it relevant to?
Your Honor, if you look at how the opening statement of the defendant began, they sort of framed the issue. They were taking a general denial of the larger amount of crack that was found in the separate bedroom, and then they were taking a lack of intent to distribute the smaller amount that was found in the dresser when you first came, that was first searched when they came in. So the importance of the prior conviction, as argued in the opening statement or implied in the opening statement of the defense attorney, was first there's two other people present. There's less than 5 grams found in this dresser next to the defendant's state of Illinois identification. The larger amount's found in a different location. There's no fingerprints, and there's no crack manufacturing equipment and no scale. So we've got a general denial of the larger amount. Fine, that's possession. You can't simply admit evidence, 404B evidence to show propensity. But on the other hand, you had the argument there was a lack of intent to distribute the smaller amount. As the evidence in the trial began to develop, it was clear that a common technique that drug dealers use is to keep the street-level distribution amounts separate from the money they're making by selling the drugs and also from their main supply. They supply their smaller amount from their main supply. If that tied into the fact that this wasn't a mistake or accident, that his smaller amount was next to his ID. It also showed he had knowledge of this technique.
I don't so far hear any answer to my question. What was this relevant to?
It was relevant first to his
conviction. Make any fact at issue more likely other than through the propensity inference?
All right. It makes it more likely, number one, that he has knowledge of the technique of separating your main supply from your street amount. That was not simply a mistake or an accident.
How does the conviction establish that?
Excuse me?
How does the conviction establish that?
It shows that he has knowledge of drug trafficking. And obviously a drug dealer isn't going to go to drug dealer U to learn these techniques. They're learned through prior conduct. And the conviction shows he's been involved in this trafficking before and he's aware of this technique of
it doesn't show he's aware of any technique. It shows he distributed drugs.
Well, he specifically distributed.
If you had evidence that he was aware of a particular technique, that would be interesting. But a conviction doesn't show awareness of any technique.
Well, certainly,
it shows distribution.
I think the average person on the street without a drug conviction would not be aware that you would want to separate your main supply from your street amount. And I don't know how else a drug dealer would learn this technique other than dealing drugs. They're certainly not going to go to a college and take drug dealing 101. So I think the fact he has a conviction tends to show he has knowledge of drug trafficking. In fact, some of the cases say that. In fact, you can use it to show knowledge of drug trafficking. It also goes to show a lack of mistake or accident. In other words, the fact that there's a small amount found by his ID.
I realize that this particular argument was rejected less than 3 weeks ago in Chavis. And the dispute in Chavis was whether such an error could be harmless or whether, as the dissenting opinion contended, it couldn't be harmless.
I'm not aware of the Chavis case, Your Honor. But we also add beyond knowledge, it goes to show that he had the intent to distribute the smaller amount because the reason that they're separated. And finally, there was a lack of mistake or accident. I'd also point out that in this case...
How does a drug conviction 10 years ago show that there was a lack of mistake now?
Well, it was only 6 years...
I just don't understand what the link is other than the propensity link.
You've had a small amount of crack next to the defendant's ID. He begins to develop the theme. He frames the issue and begins to develop the theme both in his opening statement and through his questions of Detective Ramey and Detective Stolitz, that there's really no drug trafficking taking place here. The drug's back in the back belongs to someone else. My client has no intent to distribute the drugs, and intent is an element. He had no intent to distribute the drugs that were possessed by his ID. It might have been a mistake or accident, or it might have simply been he wanted to use those himself.
Look, can you give me a straight answer to the question how the fact that he did distribute drugs 10 years ago shows that he intended to distribute drugs now, other than the propensity argument? If his argument was, I was distributing this, but I thought it was flour. I didn't know the difference between flour and cocaine or something like that. I could understand the relevance of a drug conviction to show that he knows this. But if the question is, what was my plan on Thursday, the 23rd of May, 2001, I don't know how that can be shown by a conviction for some other offense on some other date.
Well, my interpretation of the case law, and perhaps I'm not that bright, but my understanding of reading the case law was that you can admit convictions to show knowledge of drug trafficking.
Yes, you seem to be of the view that any drug conviction can be used to prove any drug crime. This court has rejected that position plenty of times, most recently in Chavis, loudly in Beasley in 1987, a case that seems to have had no effect on prosecutors or district judges. It's just not the law.
I simply rely upon the cases cited in my brief to talk about how a prior drug conviction can show knowledge of drug trafficking.
It
and
can
that
show knowledge. My question to you was, how did this one? And you haven't made any concrete connection other than the generic one, which is basically any prosecutor can prove any drug conviction in any drug case.
Well, in a specific intent crime, we have to show you had the intent to sell it. I'll put it this way. Let us presume that he never testified, that in closing argument, the defense stands up and he says, my client possessed a small amount of crack there, but there's been no evidence admitted whatsoever that he knew how to sell a large amount, nor any explanation as to how the larger amount ties into the smaller amount. I don't know how I would then say, Your Honor, I'd like to reopen the case so I can admit the fact that he, in fact, does know this technique because he's been convicted before. And if that's the basis of the argument, I'd add that we were very careful in this case to make sure that there were limiting instructions given both immediately after the introduction of this evidence and in the final instructions of the jury. And again, under the law of the circuit, that should cure any potential unfair prejudice. There's really no dispute as to the other prongs of the other three prongs of the admission of the evidence. So even if it was error, it certainly was cured by the jury instructions. And finally, although I said I'm unfamiliar with the Chavez case, based upon the overwhelming evidence in this case, the jury would have convicted him without that. I might add that the defense mutated when the defendant took the stand. If we had known the defendant was simply going to deny everything from the beginning, perhaps this evidence would not have been admitted. But hindsight is 20/20. Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Ms. Dyson?
I agree. I take the position that the prior conviction, the probative value of that conviction was greatly outweighed by its prejudicial effect. In going back
to... I'm not sure that you've preserved the relevance line of argument. Was there a relevance objection made at trial? The objection that's stressed in your brief is that it's somehow too old, so that it would be admissible if it were only 2 years old, but it's not admissible because it's older than that. And that's not responsive to the kinds of concerns I'm expressing. And indeed, it's not a relevance objection.
I'm not sure, but I believe that I did make that objection in my motion in limine, Your Honor. I don't have it before me right
certainly
now.
Certainly no relevance argument made in the appellate brief.
And that's correct, Your Honor. But I do think that I made it at the trial court. Again, I think that the conviction was unnecessary in this case. If the government had what they purported to be a confession, where the defendant is actually saying he sold drugs, he distributed drugs, there was no reason to bring in this prior conviction. Additionally, there is nothing about this prior conviction to tell the jury that that conviction involved the parceling and selling of drugs and putting drugs in different locations. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. And we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been both to your client and to the court. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow.